Our Father, we want to thank you for your goodness and your kindness to us. We want to thank you for the grace of God that has come to us in Jesus Christ. We want to thank you for the way you've worked in our country. And we would pray for our president and for those who are in charge of the temporal realm. We would pray that you would make them submissive to yourself. And we would pray for ourselves as we study church history tonight that we might see some of the great blessings that we have by having the freedoms that we enjoy. These things we pray in Jesus' name. Amen. Now the point that we covered last time, for the most part, was focusing on the rise of the Roman Catholic Church. And we have been surveying church history, and the medieval church has a development up to 600 with Gregory the Great. And then there is a decline in its fortunes, and then it reaches a pinnacle, and then it declines again into the time of the Reformation. And so the organized church in the Western Empire has its ups and downs as far as its power struggle and its solidarity. As far as its doctrinal development, well, by the grace of God, there is always within the established church a certain amount of good along with the evil. The Lord just doesn't start all over. Now tonight we want to look at a number of things that are going on in several different realms during this period in here. While the papacy is going down and then rising, we want to look at a number of features, as well as one other feature that we did not cover before. Somebody's asked me, am I going to follow the order of the textbook? Somewhat. I feel that you can read that, and if you read the textbook, then you don't want me just to repeat what the textbook says. But I will be lecturing on a few things that are similar. For next time, you should read the page 294, and that will get you up to the time of the Reformation. We want to, next time, look at people who attempted to try to reform the church in this period. When the church was going into a long period of decline and corruption, we want to look at some of the early attempts at reform, and then we will get into the interesting part of church history for all of us, the Reformation and the modern developments. So, first of all, I want to look at the rise of monasticism tonight. We have not looked at that at all, and we have just mentioned that monasticism was a factor that was developing. You get it developing in this period very much, and of course it develops all the way through church history to the present time, although today monasticism is not a great feature. So the first point, why monasticism? And the first thing we would say is that many people, because of their understanding of themselves and the world, from a philosophical input from Greek philosophy, felt that the body was evil. And they also had an understanding of 1 Corinthians chapter 7, that celibacy was better. And they realized the world was evil. And so they put these things together, and they came out with the view that, well, if celibacy is better, and if the world is evil, and if the flesh needs submission, why not separate yourself from the vanity of the world and try to have freedom from the flesh? And so monasticism arose from a godly desire, but a somewhat misunderstood emphasis, I would think. I think the monastics, for the most part, misunderstood Paul's intentionality. You need to not only read the Bible, but you also need to ask yourself, what is the point of the passage? When Paul says in 1 Corinthians chapter 7 that marriage is good, but celibacy is better, you have to ask, why did he write that and for what purpose? And is that normative for everybody? And you have just been through 1 Corinthians with Bill, and he's made the point that Paul says he would desire everybody to be as himself, but not everybody has that gift. He assumes that marriage is the norm, that every man has his own wife, and every wife have her own husband. He assumes that people will marry But he was counseling celibacy in Corinth because of the present distress. Howbeit, though, many people felt that because of the pagan world and the sensuality in it, they would get away from it. And so what they did is that various people tried various things. Some, for example, tried to live as hermits to get away from the controversy of the world. You get away by yourself and you just meditate with God, and you try to live a life which is pleasing to God as you see it. And this took place a great deal in this period here, particularly in Egypt. There was much more of the hermit-type monasticism in Egypt, and one of the reasons for it was, of course, the climate. A person could go out, live by himself, and food was fairly plentiful in Egypt at that time, and he could live an existence by himself fairly easy. Whereas in the northern climates, such as in Europe, a person had to live on some kind of a farm or a commune, and he had to have some kind of a communal organization. And so you get a different type of monasticism in Europe than you do get in Egypt. You get the development of large monasteries and the development of farms that are communally farmed, with the common good being the goal. One of the more interesting cases of hermit life that the text mentioned is Simon Stylites, who spends 30 years of his life living on a pole. I don't know if you noticed driving back and forth on the Central Expressway, but for about 7 months there was a guy living on a pole over here. But he was doing it for dollars. He was, I think, paid something like $5,000 if he would stay up there for a certain length of time. Well, this man spent 30 years on a pole, and his goal, of course, was to be separate from the world and give himself to communion with God. We would say that these people are sincere, but misguided, and that in some ways that's the easy way out. If you live by yourself, sometimes, and you're not around other people, you don't face the same antagonisms. There is the famous story in Jewish literature of the man who's called the Vilna Gaon, and he achieved great holiness, and everybody lauded him for being a great man of the Torah. And then a person said, let us see, though, if you could come down in the marketplace and live where we have to live, and let us see if you could stay the Vilna Gaon. And so there is a point that separation from the world, in the sense of actual physical removal, is sometimes far easier than for a person to try to live a sober, righteous, godly world in the midst of ungodliness. Yet it seems to me that that is what the main thrust of the New Testament is, not separation from the world, but rather a godly life penetrating the world, shining as lights in the midst of what Paul says is a crooked and a perverted generation. The weaknesses of the monastic movement, of course, would be that it tended to give levels for morality. That there were the ones who were the spiritual, and then there was the average person. And so you could sort of rationalize, well, if I'd really like to go all the way, I could go this way, but I'm just the ordinary person, and I'm going to stay at this level. And so you got two-level morality. If you want to really be with it, you drop out. And of course, that's what they really did. They simply dropped out of the organized system for the most part, particularly in Egypt. They lived in caves. It was very easy to find caves to live in. They didn't have to work very hard. So sometimes they spent a lot of time in self-mutilation and torture, trying to keep the body under. The European monasticism and the monasticism that developed around the Byzantine era was a pretty good type, in the sense that they lived in a communal type life, and they gave themselves to certain positive things. They did experimentation in farming. They worked on biblical texts, that is, they copied the text. They started schools, and so they did certain helpful things. But as a whole, the thing that the whole aspect of monasticism tended to put a damper on family life. If you wanted to be a person who was a family man, that was sort of looked down upon because you were enmeshed in the fleshly world. Secondly, it also caused a brain drain. The best minds oftentimes fled into the monasteries. So we would say that monasticism was a mixed thing for the church. There was a certain monasteries that achieved real greatness. There was one that we might mention. When we look at the area of missionary expansion, we might talk a little bit about England. And we might talk about St. Patrick. There is an article that I have in my file here called "That Scotsman, St. Patrick." He wasn't Irish. He wasn't in Dublin. He wasn't Roman Catholic. Normally we think of St. Patrick as an Irish Catholic. The fact of the matter is that he came from Scotland. He grew up in Scotland. And at age 16, he was kidnapped. And he was taken to Ireland. And while he was in Ireland, living as a slave for 6 years, he became closely attuned to the Irish people. And then when he escaped, he felt that he wanted to go back as a missionary. This area up here had a Christian movement very early. Roman soldiers went up in this area, and you had a Christian church in this area in the first century. But that declined, and in particular, Ireland was quite pagan. Then St. Patrick, as he was called, after he was converted in this process of being a slave, he decided to go back, and he came to Ireland and spent a number of years forming churches. And as the result of his missionary work, thousands of people were baptized, and a church developed in Ireland, in the northern part particularly, that was a very interesting type of church. It was not a Roman Catholic church. In fact, this whole area for a long time, from around 300 to say 600, had many features which were not connected to Roman Catholicism. For example, they did not venerate Mary. They had married clergy in this area. They followed the Eastern Rite for Easter and did not give any allegiance to Rome. So when he spent his ministry there, a church developed in Ireland which was quite orthodox in distinction from Roman Catholic. And a church continued in this area that was extremely orthodox, centered on the Word of God, centered on preaching the Scriptures, centered on immediate conversion. But what happened was eventually there was a compromise that was made by a king at a place called Whitby, in which he was choosing between the Roman Catholic faith and the Orthodox Church that was there. And he made a political decision, deciding that the Roman Catholic Church had the keys to the kingdom, what we talked about last time. And so he made a political decision, and the brilliant work that had been done in this area was lost. One of the things that we might mention was that a man from this part of the world, named Colombo, did brilliant missionary work, and he founded what was called the Iona Community and Monastery. And as a result of this community and this monastery, they trained many people in the Scriptures. There was a missionary movement, and there was widespread evangelism in this whole area. Unfortunately, just because an area has a good church for a while, that doesn't mean it's going to persist. And if you had traced the fortunes of the Irish church, you could see that they had a brilliant... they had Christianity, first of all, in the first century. Then it goes pagan. Then it goes Christian. Then it goes pagan. Then it goes sort of Eastern Catholic. And then, of course, it goes Roman Catholic. And so you get a constant change of fortunes, and as you know, even comparatively modern Irish history, you still have struggles back and forth. But the only point I bring this in is to illustrate that not everywhere in this period you have black pictures. You have certain bright lights that come on for about 100 years. You get a man like St. Patrick. By the way, he was never canonized by the Roman Catholic Church. Never invoked Mary. There was Patrick in his writings never mentions the Pope or Rome. And his grave is in a Protestant churchyard. So when a person talks about St. Patrick as being Catholic, Roman Catholic, that is very far from the facts as we know them. So you do get some brilliant things in monasticism. However, the general tenor in this period is a decline, and the church is declining for several things. You do get, in this period, with Gregory the Great, the first real statement of purgatory. You get a strong stress on baptismal regeneration, and you get the beginnings again of what we would call semi-Pelagianism. As you remember, Augustine took a very strong stand on the necessity of God's grace in this period. And the church, Western church, had a fairly good theology for a while, at least in the area of grace. But there, in this period, you're getting a decline in many areas. You're getting a merit system developing. You're getting a stress on baptismal regeneration even stronger. And in some places, you're getting the development of the sacramental view of the Lord's table. You also have some of the better minds, if you read the text, forging certain decretals in which the Pope is saying that he has certain lands that were given to him by Constantine. And so there is a period of corruption that is quite notorious in this period. And the church as a whole is beginning to lose ground in certain areas as well as gain in others. So if we look at the map of the world at that time, you're going to have growth in certain areas and loss in others. And the most famous area of loss that we need to mention is the area that is covered by the shaded areas here. The red represents the Muslim conquest. The green represents what is left of the Eastern Empire. The empire, which was at Rome, that was founded some 700 years before Christ, as you know, at one time covered the whole Mediterranean area. Finally, the barbarians that were pushing in from Europe and from the Asiatic areas, pushing into Europe and pushing the European barbarians down in, eventually wiped out Rome as a political force. The papacy stayed, of course, there. And what happened was that the empire capital, instead of being Rome, was moved to Constantinople. And so what actually was Rome in the political sphere became Constantinople. And this Eastern Empire, as we mentioned before, lasts until 1454. It has a church there, but the Western church is going to dominate for a number of reasons. Now, we need to mention a little bit about the losses that Christianity faced in this period. We could say, first of all, that you get a tremendous loss with the barbarian invasions. The church tries to do evangelistic work, but their evangelism is hindered by their faulty theology. Instead of doing evangelism in the way that we would do evangelism, they tend to try to convert whole tribes at one time. And by having the leader convert, the whole group follow him. And sometimes large movements were brought into the Christian church. They were all baptized, and they were assumed to be Christians. Of course, as you realize, that kind of evangelism doesn't really do a whole lot. But you get Asiatic hordes pushing in from here, And so tribes that are living in here keep pushing over. They push up this direction and push down in here and eventually come over into this area. So there are barbarians that are pushing down into these areas, destroying civilized places. One of the values of monasticism that we did not mention is that in this tremendous upheaval and turmoil, there will be little communities that will seek to preserve learning. What has happened, of course, is that the strong empire that was here, that dominated this area and provided political stability, has deteriorated. And so the church begins to suffer some of the consequences of living in a turmoil situation. Part of our prayer ought to be that God would give us stable government, Paul says, that we might live a quiet and peaceful life. Well, because this period of time is such a chaotic period with all the barbarian invasions going on, the church is going to be greatly in turmoil during this period. And so with the Vandals, the Franks pushing into these areas, the church faces challenges here. And so they try to convert these areas, and they, in some sense, this area does become what we would call at least Christianized. All through this area, the church becomes Christianized. And we mentioned that this area up here becomes Christianized. So the church is making gains here. But then we have another tragedy strike the church in the rise of Islam. Islam comes from this direction up here. And as you know, the facts of the matter are mentioned in your text. Muhammad, whose dates are 570 to 632, a camel driver, a Bedouin, that is, a wandering Arab from this area, he marries a rich widow who frees him from having to make a living, and so he is able to give time to religious devotion and meditation. He has what he says are revelations, and he writes them down in a book which becomes known as the Quran. He, however, had previously had made a trip to this area in here where he had become familiar with the Old Testament, with his contact with Jews, as well as with Christianized groups in the area. And so when he went back, he began preaching in the year 610 monotheism. Now, the people that he is from in this area, they are worshiping all kinds of spirits and demons and gods. And so his contact with Judaism and Christianity convinces him that he should preach monotheism, which he does. He experiences persecution. He has some converts. And he finally flees from Mecca to Medina in the year 622. He is able to get a group of people who believe in him, and he comes back to Mecca in 630 and captures it, and the movement becomes a dynamic force, and he begins to expand in all areas. Now, what does he teach? Well, Islam means resignation or surrender to God. He teaches that there is but one God, Allah. And Allah has 28 prophets. Moses is one, Noah is one, Abraham is one, Jesus is one, Alexander the Great is one. Jesus, though, is simply an apostle to the Jews. Muhammad is an apostle to the world. He is the final manifestation of the prophetic gift. He also taught that Jesus did not die on the cross. He taught that a likeness was on the cross, but Jesus actually left and went back to God. So what he has in that teaching is really a teaching which is, that's by the way, in section 4, 156 of the Quran. That is a teaching which comes from Gnosticism. So his contact with some of the early Gnostics must have given him this idea. But he denies the reality of the death of Jesus Christ on the cross. He teaches a system of works in which a person prays five times a day to Mecca. He repeats a creed. There is but one God, Allah, and Muhammad is a prophet. He practices alms. He makes a pilgrimage once in his life to Mecca. He can have only four wives at one time, no limit to concubines, and no alcohol. By 100 years later, this movement has become so widespread that it spreads all the way through Africa and comes all the way up to the city of Tours, where in 732, a man named Charles the Hammer Martel stops the Muslim advance here. And on this side, it expands this direction, of course, all this direction. And in the year 717, it is stopped here by the Eastern Empire. Leo was able to hold it off here. But for a while, it looked like the Mohammedan advance would crush and take over all of this area. Now, it's quite interesting that the church that was in this area, which was a very strong church in many respects, just about vanished. And the question is, what happened? Why did this church disfold? This church, which had survived in this area, the persecutions from 100 to 300, why did the church in this area fold so dramatically? In other words, today, to find an Arab who's a Christian is a rarity. Although there are, of course, small Arab communities in here that are Christians, and you have Coptic Christians in this area. Two explanations have been given as to what happened to the African church. The first explanation is that the Muslims forced the Christians to convert, either convert or else be killed by the sword. But the problem is that as you examine the records, there does not seem to be very much truth to that claim. People who wanted to remain Christians could. They were considered people of the book, along with Jews and Zoroastrians. And so a person could stay as a Christian in a Muslim land. They suffered discrimination, but their lives were guaranteed. They had to wear a patch of distinctive color on their clothing as a mark of inferiority. They had to pay high taxes or tribute. And they could not have a high post in government. They could not build new churches nor ring church bells. They could not ride donkeys on the streets lest they make them taller than a passing Muslim. But apart from that, they could practice their faith. And so the idea that the church was wiped out because it was the sword or perish does not seem to fit the facts. Some have argued that the reason why the church declined in these areas was because a law of apostasy was passed, or a law of conversion, that a person could convert only one way. He could convert to Muslim from Christianity, but not from Muslim to Christianity. And that had a way that the Christians couldn't maintain their strength. And so the Christians died out in that direction. But that, of course, does not explain how the Christians did not succeed in perpetuating themselves as far as the reaching their own children. There seem to be five other reasons as to why, and this is, I think, fairly instructive for us if we might learn why we should study church history. The first reason that is given by some historians as to why the church did not survive in Africa is because the scriptures were never translated into the languages of the people. The church as a whole in this area had Latin, but people who lived in this area were not Latin-speaking. There were various tribes peoples that had been conquered by the Romans, had their own languages, and they did not have the scriptures translated into their own languages, such as the Berbers and others. And so Christianity to them was something which was imposed upon them, and they never really had a strong hold in it. where the scriptures were translated, such as in this area, into the Coptic, the Sahidic and Bulharic versions, a Coptic church did survive, and it has survived to the present day. So it does teach us something that if the people have the Word of God in their own language, and they are reading the Word of God, they're usually able to sustain themselves, or at least it might have been a better chance for them to survive in this area if they had had the Scriptures in their own language. A second reason for the decline is that the Eastern Church, as well as the Western Church, had lost its sense of the divine and had lost its sense of saving grace. The heart of Christianity was the doctrine of grace, and it was blunted. And in areas like this, a moralism had developed which simply could not stand the persecution that arose. So the moralism and lack of the doctrine of grace would be another major factor for the loss. A third was a lack of stress on the spiritual life in the churches. A fourth is the lack of any missionary expansion. These churches in here did not have, in this period, say 600, any desire for missions. They were just content. They were sort of dormant churches. And then when the Muslim advance came through, it just wiped them out. And some historians feel that if a church does not a missionary church, if a church does not have a vision for reaching out, it doesn't have a very firm hold on the gospel. And so that is another explanation as to what happened. And probably the main reason that the church really did not last in these areas in this period was that the church was not really indigenous. It was a foreign church. It was headed up by the Eastern Patriarch here or the Roman Pontiff here. And the church was never really something that was part of the people. It was something which was imposed upon them. And so for these reasons, the whole church, the church of Carthage, which produced a man like Tertullian, the church of Hippo, that produced a man like Augustine, and saw many of its labors, this whole area was lost and has never been regained. Today, it is some of the toughest missionary work is in this area. Christians are just not able to get through for the most part. There are some notable exceptions, but for the most part, this area is a strong Muslim area even today. One other thing that we might say as another reason why the Mohammedans made such great progress is that the Christians were pretty much divided at this period again. The Eastern and Western Church was beginning to go its separate ways, and there was a lack of unity. We might at this point trace what actually causes the final split between Rome and this Eastern Church. We have mentioned, of course, that when the empire was divided into two sections, Rome fell, and the Roman Catholic pontiff becomes the only real powerful force that is left in this area. And so he begins to exercise political as well as spiritual, whereas over in this area, you have a strong emperor, and he is over the church. And so you're going to get conflicts. Here you get the ecclesiastical over the temporal, and here you get the temporal over the ecclesiastical. And you're getting this constant power struggle, and the two will see differently on different points, at points of controversy. We mentioned that there was the filioque division. The Eastern Church did not accept the addition to the Nicene Creed. We've mentioned that before. We might mention also the iconoclastic controversy which develops. The Eastern Empire was very sensitive because of the pressure of the invading Muslims. They had to interact with some of the Muslim theology. And you see, the Muslims were saying that the Christians were idolaters. They were worshiping idols. They were worshiping Mary. They were bowing down to images. And so the Eastern Church became very sensitive about this point. And the Eastern Church passed certain laws that you could not kneel down to pictures, you could not kneel down to statues, you could not have statues. You could only have certain types of things which have come down to us being called icons. You could not have a figure in the round made into a bust or anything like an idol. Whereas the Western Church did not feel that pressure as much, and so in the Western Church, with the mixture from these pagan tribes, you get a veneration of relics, you get the development of what we would call idols, relics, as well as statues. A Roman Catholic does not say he worships them, but he venerates them. Whereas the Eastern Church felt that they could not have anything to do with it because it was causing such great controversy in their interactions with the Muslims. And so you have an ecumenical council called at Nicaea in the year 789, in which the Eastern Church says that they cannot venerate even any icon. When you get to this period, we're around 800 when we're talking here, you have a development of an empire which develops in here called what some have called the Holy Roman Empire with Charlemagne. Charlemagne, he rejected this decision of the Eastern Empire, and so you get again a conflict in practice. Charlemagne's empire develops quite strongly in this area, and then when it is divided, it's divided up into three pieces, which has come down to us today as Germany, France, and Italy, his three sons. The final thing that really causes the division between this church and this church was a controversy concerning the ecclesiastical observance of the Lord's table, as to what form it should be done and what days it should be done. They finally decide that it is to be done on a certain day and only with unleavened bread. The church in the West is using leavened bread. Certain emissaries from here go to here to discuss some differences. When the head of the church here will not see things their way, they excommunicate him, and he anathematizes them. So by the year 1054, you get two separate churches, the Eastern Church and the Western Church. The Eastern Church will, of course, influence Russia more, and you get its influence in this area somewhat. The Western Church is what we have been most influenced by. This church becomes very much ingrown and stays put until the year 1453, when the empire falls. And then this church that is in this area will be under the Muslim and Turkish domination until World War I. So this church, the Eastern Church, had its tremendous struggles. The very fact that the Eastern Church was able to survive under repressive government all the time, whether it was the emperor or whether it was the Muslims or the Turks, with only brief periods in which there was a slight amount of freedom, is an amazing testimony to the fact that in spite of the failure of men, God did use certain things to support it. So you get two churches, an Eastern Church and you get a Western Church. Now, we might talk a little bit about some of the political developments. We have mentioned the development in here of what was called the Holy Roman Empire with Charles the Hammer Martel, 732. And then you get Pepin the Short, who follows him, and then his giant son, Charlemagne, who is crowned by the Pope as the head of the Roman Empire, the Holy Roman Empire. And this empire persists for a while and then divides, and then once again you get a decline because you get a constant power struggle between the three powers as to who is running the show, whether it's going to be the temporal head or whether it's going to be the ecclesiastical head. And you are still getting invasions from this area, and then you're going to get invasions along in here from the Norsemen, the Vikings. So this is a tremendous area, a tremendous time of flux all during this period. And it would be a period, I'm sure, that most of us would not have enjoyed living in too much because of the tremendous controversy that is going on. Now, going back to our chart, the papacy, which has been going on a decline from 600 down to 950, begins to come to a rise in its temporal power. There has been an expansion of the church in many areas. We might just point out one other thing in the expansion of the church. Although the church has lost down in here, and it has lost in a split here, we have the following. There is expansion into Denmark by Harald Bluetooth. There is expansion into Norway. There is St. Olaf who goes there and makes the country so-called Christian. In Sweden, there is also a King Olaf who adopts Christianity. There is the spread to Iceland, in which a Christianized community is introduced from Scandinavia. And, of course, you get Eric the Red and Leif Erikson, who possibly reach America. And you get the spread into Russia, from Sweden into Russia. In this area, you get some missionary movement. And you get movements down into Bohemia and Poland at this time, as well as a counter-thrust back into Spain, subjugating the Moors and making Spain Christianized. So there is missionary activity, somewhat directed from Rome and somewhat spontaneous from various mission groups, from various monasteries. Now, the papacy begins to have a development in this period, which reaches its high point in Innocent III. And one of the things that makes the big issue in this period is, who has the right to appoint bishops to churches? And in particular, the issue arises in Germany. Because if you can appoint the bishops, that means you can control the church. If Nixon had the right to appoint the heads of the church, of course, you can see where the power is. If the church appointments are made by the Pope, you can see where the power is. And so there's a constant struggle back and forth between the various factions as to who has the right. And when a strong political ruler is on the scene, he will sometimes try to control the Pope. When the Pope becomes strong, he will try to control the political leaders. And so you will get situations like this. You get sometimes when a pope dies, the various emperors will get together and they will try to influence the election because they don't want a strong pope. Because if they get a strong pope, then this guy is going to give them grief and he's going to be pushing for power. So you get these struggles. And I'll just mention some of them. You get a man by the name of Otto the First, who lives in the year 936-973. He aids Pope John, and he becomes crowned emperor of the revived Roman Empire as the result of his helping the Pope. His successor, Otto III, gets rid of the Pope and decides to put his own man on the throne. And he becomes the master of all Italy, and then he puts his own man, Gregory the Fifth, as a pope. And then you get a reaction against this. And so you're having a constant struggle back and forth between the two. It reaches an interesting point when a man named Henry the Fourth is struggling over with the pope, and he has to come down and beg for forgiveness 3 days in the cold snow before the pope will forgive him because the pope now has the power. Innocent the Third, who is in this period, and he becomes the zenith of papal power His dates are 1161 to 1216. He becomes pope in the year 1198. He is a very young man when he becomes pope. He's only 37, 1 year younger than I am. And he is able to bring all of Europe under his direct control. So what the various popes have been trying to do to control this entire area from Rome, this man is able to achieve. He is able to do it in such a way that everybody has to be in submission to him. And he wins certain key battles. He wins everywhere he fights. He wins in Germany, in France, in Spain, and in England. In Germany, after Henry the VI died, Innocent favors Otto over Philip for the German throne, and then he later excommunicates him and deposes him. So he actually controls who becomes the... He's powerful enough to control the election, and he gets this man elected, and when his man who is elected does not suit his fancy, he excommunicates him, and Germany then is given to a new man as a fief of the papacy. So he virtually owns Germany and lets it out to a man as his vassal. So this is a high point of feudalism when a man can hand over a whole country and then receive the homage of a person who rules that whole country. Philip, in this period, there's a Philip who is ruling in France. And he is engaged and finally is married to Ingeborg of Denmark. Some of these marriages were arranged, and this one was. He claimed, after he got the wife, that he had been bewitched, and he wanted to get a divorce. The wife complained to the Pope, and so the Pope proclaimed an interdict on the whole country, which means nobody can be buried, nobody can be married, and nobody can be baptized, and so on. And so the man was forced to submit, take his wife back, and so he had France under his thumb. In Spain, he forced Alfonso I to dismiss his wife because he felt it was an invalid marriage. And in England, you have the controversy between King John and the Pope over the successor to Thomas à Becket, the murdered Archbishop of Canterbury. You remember, of course, the recent film that was made in this. The Pope threatened interdict on the whole country, and John, the king, promised to murder every Italian in England. The Pope excommunicated John and released his subjects and urged war on John. And so John had to say, "I yield." He gave back all of England to the Pope and purchased it back, paying an annual rent to the papacy. So with this kind of power, in which a man controls this absolutely, you get an entirely different character of Christianity here than you do here. In this particular situation, the emperor always has control of the church. You get corruption in both places, and in both places the corruption is caused by the union of church and state, or else the supremacy of church over state. There is no idea at this point of separation or of two different kinds of Christianity or of religious freedom. Now, that is a foreign notion. You are not going to get that until a good while down the line. Now, at this point, we might mention the Crusades that took place. When you get this kind of a situation, there is a lot of energy pent up, and there are new movements. Instead of the barbarians coming in, these lines become fairly stabilized. And so the Muslims are still pushing on the Eastern Empire. The Eastern Empire asks for help from the West, asking their Christian brothers to help them. And so from this area, the First Crusade is going to be launched to go through here and to rescue the Holy Land and to save the Eastern Empire from the Muslim hordes. And so you get the military enterprises called the Crusades that attempt to free this area and save this empire. Why do these people want to go there? Well, they have several reasons. They want to free the Holy Land from the Turks. They want to make pilgrimages to the Holy Land. There is, again, the veneration of relics and holy places. And so they have not been permitted to go there very much, or to go there without being bothered by the Turks. And so they want to rid the land and free the holy places. The Pope wants to unite this area, and he hopes by the Crusades, with military forces going through here, that he will be able to unite the whole thing under his control. The serfs, peasants, oftentimes were willing to go on a crusade because they wanted to get rid of their lords above them. And this was a way of adventure, getting off the land, going on an adventure for a holy cause, and hoping that you could accomplish something. And the kings sometimes supported them because they felt if some of their rivals were out of the way, they could do what they wanted here. And so you might encourage your friendly neighbor king to go on a crusade, and you could take over his kingdom while he is gone. The first crusade, which comes in the year 1095 to 1099, was really a result of preaching in this area, and unorganized French peasants flocked to this area. And they didn't get very far. They were sold into slavery, and it was a tragic situation. They were either slaughtered or else sold into slavery. A second phase of the same crusade was organized by nobles, and they came and they did rescue this area. And for a number of years, some 50 years, this area was in Christian hands. Numbers of castles were built, and they tried to set up a feudal kingdom in this area. Howbeit, though, the Muslims mustered another attack, recaptured Jerusalem and a number of the holy places, and once again began threatening the Eastern Empire, and so a second crusade was called. The second crusade was unsuccessful. A third crusade was called. The third crusade was a crusade of kings. Frederick of Germany, Richard the Lionhearted, and Philip all decided to go on a crusade. They got into fighting among themselves, and actually only Richard the Lionhearted actually ended up on the battlefield. He was partially successful, did not really accomplish it. And then there was a children's crusade, which was again another travesty, did not accomplish very much. The results of the crusades, it opened Europe to another part of the world. And they began to realize that as the result of trade with this area into this area, and they brought back a number of things from here, they realized there was a whole other world. And so it has important ramifications from that point of view. It weakens the feudalism that was controlling the society structure here. It also caused the church to gain certain power. Towns began to grow instead of just farm. You got a development of commerce between these areas, and you have a movement toward the cities and the development of learning from some of the Muslim scholars who were studying Aristotle and other things. It stimulated the Europe quite a bit. One other feature we want to mention in this period that we are getting developing in this area, we are getting a movement which is known as Scholasticism. Scholasticism is an intellectual movement that is developing along with all these other political and ecclesiastical movements, which is an attempt to reconcile philosophy with the biblical revelation. It's an attempt to rationalize what you believe in order to buttress your faith, and it was sparked by a renewal of the study of Augustine, pardon me, renewal of the study of Aristotle, which was brought in from the Crusades. And so there was the rise of universities, and people began to investigate things, and a whole movement which develops, which we now call Scholasticism. The more famous names are Anselm, who developed the famous ontological proof for God, trying to justify the belief in God by rational means. And Anselm made a brilliant argument, which people still debate today, whether it's valid or not. In fact, I have a book on my desk, which was just written by a professor at Oxford, debating the validity of Anselm's proof. He argues that the very concept of God in our minds, that there is... see if I can state it. If you can think of a most perfect thing, which would be God, there cannot be anything greater which you cannot conceive. He goes on to say that if a person conceives of that which no greater than he can be conceived, let me start all over again. If you start with the idea of God, he argues that the very fact that man has this idea argues for the reality of it. Because God is the most perfect idea that could possibly be held in our minds. If somebody said, well, having the most perfect idea in your minds does not guarantee that it has real existence, he would say that if you have an idea in your mind which is not real, then it is not the most perfect idea, because the most perfect idea also has real existence. And it's quite a subtle argument, and he set it forth, and people have been arguing over it ever since as to whether or not you can prove God's existence by a strictly logical argument. Abelard is another great name in Scholasticism. Peter Lombard, who wrote the famous sentences, then Albert Magnus, and this reaches its high point in Scholasticism in a man called Thomas Aquinas. We have not mentioned him yet. Thomas Aquinas is the father of Roman Catholic theology. He is a person who tries to reconcile Aristotle with what the church has been teaching, and he synthesizes the two. And this synthesis is what is come to be known as Scholasticism. Aristotelian philosophy and Scholasticism become the doctrine of the church until the current days. Today, still in certain Catholic circles, Thomas Aquinas, or Thomistic philosophy, is the official teaching of the church. And so there is an intellectual development in this period which persists to the present day, an attempt to reconcile philosophy with Christianity, which gives rise to the system of Thomas Aquinas, who was a tremendous scholar in the sense of writing, and as a result of his achievement, the Roman Catholic Church is able to survive intellectually, at least, until this day. The man Albert Magnus, who preceded him, we might just point out that Albert Magnus synthesized Aristotelianism. He synthesized also the Muslim teaching along with the Jewish teaching of Maimonides. And so you get a tremendous synthesis going on between what was traditional Christianity with all kinds of pagan amalgamation, or amalgamation from other sides. This is going to cause a corruption which is going to go into the organized church, and Luther is going to be the heir of all this, trying to find the pure word of God and finding it tremendously overlaid with philosophy, with tradition, with pagan thinking.